Thank you very much, Jane. So I think we can quite begin, because, well, firstly, I'm very glad to be here. I hope you will enjoy Dublin too. Mm-hmm. And second thing, I must apologize. Would a rhetorician of the 16th century or the 15th century be here? Would be horrified about my English. But I hope we'll be much more generous than a rhetorician of the 15th century. So, So I will just begin and try to speak with you, to talk with you about this anti-Aristotelianism. What is it, what it means, what kind of philosophy is attached to it. And, well, I have chosen two examples. The text that I have given you are written by two key authors of anti-Aristotelianism in the 16th century. The first one, as you have seen, is Tommaso Campanella, which is in fact the younger of the two, because he dies in the 30s of the 17th century. And the second one is Giordano Bruno, which is maybe one of the most well-known philosophers against Aristotle in the 16th century. Now, my next question is, how did you find these texts? Were they readable? Were they completely out of any imagination? Did you find them interesting, annoying?
This one was almost like the Giordano Bruni, the dialogue. It was almost like reading poetry, or sort of rhetoric. You know, the speeches were so balanced and
florid.
Very florid. That's a very good word. I didn't retain that.
Fascinating. Yeah, I think that's very important, and we will come back to this. And in fact, if you look also the other one, that of Campanella, which is taken from the City of the Sun, which is probably a quite well-known work of Campanella. If you see, it's a poetical dialogue. So there is nothing technical in this kind of philosophy. They both are writing something else. It's not a treatise, it's not a normal way of speaking about philosophy. We'll come back to that. I would like to come back now to what we said last week with David, because this is a sort of filigrane, you say, to understand what's happening. We talked about humanism and this attitude to give importance to the language, to grammar, and the activity of translating and retranslating works of the past, of the remote antiquity. And we have seen that specifically in the field of Aristotelian text, but this happens also with other traditions and philosophers. And we said that one most important field was moral. They were working about moral, ethics, and politics, and these kind of things. But in fact, we can say the same about the other fields of philosophy. And what is very important is that humanists began to work also on texts which are texts of what we now call physics or natural philosophy. So, for example, they worked a lot on medical texts, which means working on Galen and Hippocrates, which are the ancient, the most ancient medical writers. And this is very important because they exercise also their interpretation, their capability of interpreting this text, and they discover also issues of method, methodological issues. For example, Hippocrates is very important because it shows a particular attitude toward observation in the sense of seeing symptoms, for example. And in this huge work, they also traduce new works. For example, Dioscoride, which will be an important author for the Renaissance. And he's speaking about the Arte Medica in general. And this gives some other, let's say, puts other questions in the field. And then one must say that this huge work of the humanists, for example, takes to the discovery in St. Gallen of the entire text of Lucrezio, the Rerum Natura, which was unknown. And Poggio Bracciolini goes there and finds the text. And this is something which is a real other way of explaining nature. It is the let's say, the manifesto of the atomism in the Latin world. So it's something really new. And maybe you have heard about the Swerve, was a book. Illustrates the journey of Poggio Bracciolini toward St. Gallen and toward the discovery of this text. And another important thing is they also find and retranslate or translate secondary literature, for example, so the lives of Diogene Laerzio. You know, we were saying that Cicerone was the main source of the history of philosophy. Now other sources are coming, and so other philosophers are described and discussed. What also happens, coming back to the Aristotelian corpus, is that they begin to look at it more critically, and they discover that there are some problems. You remember we said that Aristotle was very inviting because he was a complete system. And so the universities came to the point that they reproduce it in their structure, the tree of knowledge in Aristotelian sense. Now the problem is that looking at the texts, first of all, they see that there are inconsistencies in the style. And there are inconsistencies in the doctrines. In fact, this was not so difficult to be seen because the Aristotelian corpus is a very heterogeneous corpus arising from notes of scholars, disciples, remaking, commentaries, and very different sort of things. But now they really see that there is something difficult to be maintained. And in particular, the natural philosophical text begin to be a stake, let's say. And there are huge discussions about, for example, key concepts of the natural philosophy of the physics. For example, the idea of the matter. How is matter to be conceived? How does it really work, so this idea of privation and form and changing and synonyms, and what's that? Okay. Another thing is that they realize that Aristotle is a man, and that there is an idea of time in the tradition. So this perfect authority becomes to be put into history. You have seen last time Bruni writes a life of Aristotle. Well, also then the anti-Aristotelian will begin to write or to consider the life of Aristotle and the attitude of Aristotle as a man. His way to look at philosophy, his way to construct his system. Another thing that we had seen is that with humanism, the discussion about philosophy and philosophical problems comes also outside the universities. You have mentioned last time, I'm sorry, I'm opening a little bit. We have seen last time that there are courts, and there are the academical circles where people meet together and speak about philosophy, or text, or literature, or politics, or what they want. And this is, in a sense, a very important change, because culture was, during the Middle Ages, concentrated in by the monks and by the universities. We can say they are lowers were very, very acculturated and sometimes worked a lot, but the main center of culture were the monastery and the university. And now there is much more around these institutions. And in this sense, we spoke last time of Ficino, which in fact founded a new Platonic academy in Florence. And this academy had a very large influence in the sense of the new structure of meeting other philosophers, and also because you know, last time we have said that in the universities the question, the disputation, was the main form of doing philosophy. Now here you are among friends, so you obviously dispute and argue nonetheless. But the idea is that you are between equal people talking about humanities. So humans talking about humanities. Hmm? Everybody is on the same level somehow. Ideally. Mm-hmm. what does Ficino do? We said he translated the Corpus Platonicum, so he retranslated all the dialogues of Plato, new ones, and also dialogues like the Timaeus, which were well known also during the Middle Ages. And he present all the dialogues together, introduced by little discussions or commentaries. Very important about this is the commentary or the introduction to the Symposium, which becomes an independent work, De Amore, which will have a lot of influence not only in the philosophy but also in literature and in a, let's say a sort of trendy way of speaking about things all over Europe. Okay. Ficino does another thing. Ficino translated also the Hermetica. Have you ever heard about that? These are the works of Hermes Trismegistus. Trismegistus, because he is a legislator. No problem, absolutely. You are.
Sue.
You
might take it.
Sue. Yeah. Thank you. a legislator, a king, and a priest. So he's the ideal ruler in a platonic way. And this corpus of the Hermetica consists in 15 dialogues, which then become 16. Because they find other works. And why is Ficino so enthusiastic about this literature, this kind of work? Because he thinks the Hermetica contain quite the same doctrines as the Christian doctrines.
Mm-hmm. What happened is
Trismegistus.
Yes. Was he a real person or an ideal person?
It's an ideal person.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
But they don't think so. Ficino wouldn't say it's an ideal person. Ficino would say it's a real person who was taught in ancient Egypt, which in the Timaeus is said to be the source of all knowledge. And the thing is that Ficino is convinced to find the doctrine of the unity of God in this works, and also the idea of the Trinity. Now, and do you need something?
Need a pen, please.
Oh!
Thank you so much. Not at my best at the moment.
And yeah, and he thinks that Hermes has taught Moses.
Moses.
Oh. Moses. Yeah. So. This way, Ficino imagines a continuous tradition of wisdom from the very beginning in ancient Egypt until his own time. To this tradition belong most Greek philosophers and also other philosophers from the East, like, for example, the Chaldean. And Ficino wrote a work, the Theologia Platonica, to tell this true truth. And the problem is, they don't know yet, that these texts are so similar to the Christian text because they have been written after the birth of the Lord Jesus. They are Platonical works mixed from the 2nd to the 4th century after Christ. But it will take more than one century until Isaac Casaubon, in the 17th century, 1640, will explain that this is a fake work. He didn't manage to convince everybody. And in fact, also during the 16th century, there are voices which at least question about this text. But the enthusiasm is so much that the tradition goes on. Now, as said, Ficino imagines a long tradition of what he calls pia philosophia. So a pious philosophy. Pious because it's also speaking about theological truth and important ethical truth, depending from the theological view. The question is, how are we to? How can be Aristotle situated in this tradition? Is he part of a tradition or not? What do you think?
No.
In fact, after this parallel to the Platonic revival, there are people arguing who is better Plato, is better Aristotle. For example, in the 50s, Cardinal Bessarion, who was notoriously a Platonician, was attacked by George of Trebizond, I think. And they exchange a polemic and about who is the best philosopher, Aristotle or Plato. And the solution are two. Either one decides that one of the two is the best, that's the case of Giorgio di Trebisonda, or one decides that the two are compatible. Yeah? And you try to explain then the philosophy of one using the categories of the other, which is very dangerous. But in fact, Ficino is quite convinced that you can consider Aristotle in a way not rightly belonging to this tradition, but he thinks you can try a common field, let's say. And Pico is not so convinced. And going on, this will be much more a problem than that will find need so much acceptance, let's say. And in the 16th century, there will be, in particular, one author who is known as one of the most strong anti-Aristotelian, which is Francesco Patrizzi, who writes in 1571 a huge book which he duplicates in the 10 years afterwards, exactly saying that it is impossible to consider Aristotle in the tradition of the Pia Philosophia, because he himself, as the disciple of Plato, has gone against his own original, how you say, doctrines. As a disciple of Plato, he was on the right way. But then, and here comes out how they spoke about the person Aristotle, he was so arrogant and so selfish that he decided to destroy his teacher, the doctrine of his teacher, and he decided to destroy the authority of any other philosopher before him.
Aristotle.
Yeah. So Patrizio says, for example, at the beginning of the metaphysics, there is a sort of history of metaphysics where all the philosopher, the pre-Socratic philosopher, are listed. And Patrizio says, Aristotle only tries to destroy them, but he uses the material of their thought to construct his own. And then he selfish and arrogantly goes his own way. Okay? So it is impossible for this kind of anti-Aristotelians to consider Aristotle part of the common heritage, cultural heritage, let's say. just to conclude this sort of recalling of we have quite all said, you remember there was this insistence of the humanists on eloquence. Eloquence is becomes quite a method in a Platonic perspective. That is, if possible, even more true, because Platonists think that God created the world through the word. Christ is the word of God, and it was through Christ, the Logos, that that God created the world. The same word is the rest of divinity in man. What after the sin is still in man from his original divinity. So to speak well is to think well. And you have a sort of guarantee that you are well thinking because you are well speaking. Well speaking does mean well, good construction, grammatically good, rhetorically good, these kind of things. But in the let's say in the first in the last part of the 15th century, also one begins to consider the quality of this very eloquent new translations. And there is a famous dispute between Giovanni Pico della Mirandola and Ermolao Barbaro. Which is a very important humanist in Venice, and they quarrel about the quality of the new translations. And Pico, in this case, says or maintains that the technical rude translations of the Middle Ages were much better from a philosophical point of view than the new humanistic translations, because he begins to think that the humanists are too much involved in aesthetic and in imitation. Imitation of the good style of Cicero, for example. Yeah. So, in the background, you have this discussion about what is best: to have a good translation, a good philosophical translation, in a bad style, or is it best? It is better to have a less good philosophical translation, where you don't really understand what's going on, in a much better style, in a much more elegant style. we leave the question open, okay? And then we will see. Now I would say we try to jump in time, in the time, and situate us, let's say, in the second half of the 15th century, of the 16th century. So after 50-50, 50 under 50. May I ask you, what do you think are the main things that happened between, let's say, the end of the 15th century and the second half of the 16th century? What happened? In general, not only
Reformation.
Reformation. Reformation. Very complicated thing. All over Europe with different issues, different constellations, different reactions. When you say that Reformation, you will say maybe also our side, but Italian side.
Renaissance.
Renaissance in general, but counter-reformation.
Counter-reformation.
Which is much more complicated than that one thinks, but we will now just take that as a label, not to go into it. Okay, Reformation. And the Reformation, you know, all the doctrines of the Counter-Reformation were decided and published, let's say, in the Council of Trent, which is between runs between 1545 and 1563, where, by the way, the church decided that the only acceptable philosophical interpretation of the world was that given in Aristotelic terms by Thomas of Aquin. So, if you look in general at other particular and very impressive events, let's say, if I say the 90s of the 15th century, 1492.
Discovery of America.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Discovery of America. Mm-hmm. The discoveries. The great discoveries. There you begin. So we have Reformation, discoveries. You begin with America, a little bit like per chance, and then you begin with all the political implications of having found new territories. But the important thing is that you have new people, new lands, and a new heaven. Because if you go under the equatorial line, you find new stars. Which is a problem. A little bit of a problem. Okay? So the discoveries. Then, maybe another, let's say, a little bit earlier as the end of the 15th century, but a really important cultural, political, economical event.
The fall of Constantinople.
Yes, the fall of Constantinople, absolutely. That will bring to Florence a lot of new manuscripts, new people from Greece, and will really give an impulse to learning Greek, and also to consider new commentaries and new types of ways of looking at the works of the antiquity. But much terra would one you would say in Italian.
What? The invention of printing.
Exactly, mm-hmm. The invention of printing. Invention of printing, which is very important, not only because it gives much more people the possibility of reading and of learning, and in this sense it is very near to the Reformation, because the Reformation without printing would haven't been the same, but also it gives a new space of cultural encounters, because many of the philosophers who don't work at the university begin, for example, to work for the publishers at a very high level sometimes. For example, Aldo Manutius, one of the most important printers in Italy, and in Europe, who, by the way, published the whole works of Aristotle in Greek.
Wow.
And a lot of things in Greek. Aldo Manuzio had a sort of circle around him, working for him and for the publication. Erasmus also was there, for example. Mm-hmm. And then, if we say maybe one or two very famous and very important books that are published in the first half of the 16th century, what would you think about? Can say 5043 is a very important year, something which has to do with discoveries, not directly, but which has a link to discoveries. Remember the new heaven?
Was it a map?
In a sense, it was a new map of what?
The world.
Of the world.
World.
Of the heaven.
The heaven.
Huh? It was Copernicus. Copernicus changes completely the image of the world and opens the door to new doctrines which go much further than he himself. Hmm? What's the point by Copernicus?
The Earth goes round the sun.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The world is round the sun. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is, why is it so important, the change? Why the change is so important? Also, we had the sun, the Earth.
Yeah.
And then the heavens. Hmm? Yeah. And now we have the sun. Mm-hmm. And then we have, in reality, we have Mercury, and then we have the Earth, and the moon and the Earth.
Yeah.
Now we have the moon here, Mercury here, and the Earth here, and then we have Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Why is it so tremendous to say something like that.
I was thinking before that the thought that the Earth was the centre of the universe.
Yes.
And now suddenly the Earth is a subsidiary body.
Exactly.
Something else.
So the centre. Do you write centre or centre?
R-E.
Yeah.
That's an amazing paradigm shift. That must have given a lot of ideas.
And
totally different.
Yeah,
paradigm.
You know, you think of the dignity of man, all the things you have written and read. The man is the center. Everything is coming to the man, and then the man is one of the others.
Yeah.
And there are problems connected to this because on one side we will see with Galileo and the new science the Bible says something else because the Bible says the sun moves. But there is also a very philosophical and technical problem with this new image of the universe, because do you remember the Aristotelian vision of the world was a Ptolemaic one, Ptolemy takes from Aristotle. But Aristotle was also describing the Earth. And how was the Earth? What was the real difference between the Earth and the heavens.
The heavens were unchangeable.
The heavens were unchangeable. Mm-hmm. The earth was so structured that there was real earth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there was water. And then there was air. And then there was fire. Oh. And these are the four elements of the Aristotelian physics. And every change in the earth, on the earth, was explicable in the sense that we live in a world of commissions, where everything is connected, every element is connected to the other in a sort of melting matter. But each of the element wants to go back to his natural place, which is in this order, hierarchic order. If you pull, and then after the fire, you had the real heavens, which were made out of quintessence, of this ethereal matter, which was unchangeable. Remember this. You can imagine when Galileo will come and say, "Oh look, I've seen spots on the sun and on Jupiter." Everything is turned upside down. But here too, if the Earth is not in the center but in the heavens, things are very difficult to be accepted. So in fact, when the words of Copernicus are published, someone writes an anonymous preface in which it's said that it is not a physical hypothesis. It is a pure mathematical hypothesis. So it's just because it is too difficult to calculate the motions of the heavens in the Ptolemaic system that we imagine the heaven in the way Copernicus does. But in fact, we are not speaking about a real nature of the heaven or of the earth. That's the background. Now, the other very important book, which gives a lot to think about, is the book of Vesalius. He writes a book of anatomy, in fact. And the great impact of the book is also that the book is illustrated by in part by Vesalius, in part by a disciple of Tintoretto. So the illustrations are very, very, very good and very, very impacting. And he really analyzed the anatomy of the body, which begins to be another stone to a transformation also in medicine, which was also organized by the doctrine of Galenus, who held four humors to be the elements of our well-being, let's say. Mm-hmm. And the well-being was the balance between these humors. Mm-hmm. Okay. Besides. We will see that exactly these kind of problems come out in the text we have read, or not read, or will try to read. I would say, if you think, we could begin just to have a couple of ideas, to throw a couple of ideas about the city of the sun. Mm-hmm. And then go to the more heavy Brunian dialogue, yeah, let's say. Mm-hmm. As you very interesting said, this is something which is literature more than canonical philosophy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, what is this? Did you ever heard about this city of the sun? Mm, yes. No, it's what is called an utopia, which is let's say ideal project of an ideal city. Mm? And in fact, Campanella writes it at the beginning of the 17th century. And publish it in the 20s of the 16th century, of the 17th century. And it is a kind of half Platonic city with other elements in it. Mm-hmm. Now, do you know anything about Campanella?
No.
Well, if you want to know something about Campanella, I can give you this information. There is a very good book translated in English about Campanella, which is a very important figure, and I didn't find the book. That's why I'm giving you the photocopies. And he was a monk. Hmm? He was a Dominican. Hmm. And the peculiarity of his life is that he spent most of his life in jail. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because he was a monk coming from South Italy, and South Italy was at that time under the government of Spain, ruled by the Spaniards. And Campanella thought he was a prophet and a very a real extraordinary person who would be invited by the heavens to realize a deep reformation. And this reformation was also a political one. So at the end of the 16th century, he organized a real revolution, which didn't succeed. And he was arrested and began 20 years of life in jail. Hmm? I must say he was a very particular man, and he wrote all his lifelong, and you can imagine in which difficulties, in which situation, because he didn't have paper, for example. Mm. Or it was very difficult for him to have books. Mm. or to transport and keep with him what he had written. So sometimes he had to rewrite what he had written because he just lost it. Mm-hmm. And he was very, very... was alone in the jail. Was he was sometimes visited by other people. Not always people who would help him. But it was a real difficult situation. And this situation, he felt himself really as signed by God and by the heavens as a new force, a new Mercury, the one who would change the very hard situation in which South Italy was and all Europe was. And so also this idea of being in a car in jail gets re-elaborated by him, who thinks in a very Platonic way, I am in a carcel, I am in jail, but I see the truth, you know, the myth of the cavern. So everything becomes very twingled, let's say, you know, biography and thought and political program, and that's why he can also write, he writes also rhymes, for example, verses. He writes a lot. He writes also treatises. But let's say the way he writes is nevertheless always very literal, very creative. Because also this kind of philosopher think that you get in a sort of... enthusiasm when you write, and you have to have an impact on the listener in a more complex way than just a simple, let's say, a cold, rational syllogism. Okay, that's the way. You must really convey all your force and all your soul in thinking what you are doing. And on this, I would say we make a break, get a coffee, and then begin with the text. Oh, please interrupt me whenever you want. Also, when I'm not clear,
A couple of questions about humanists reading medical texts. Did they also do any medical research or something, or was it simply looking at the old texts, or did they do anything practical?
Maybe at the beginning in Italy, they were looking at those texts real just as text. But for example, there is a very strong school of medical humanists in Germany and in Switzerland, in Basel, where Vesalio was published. These people study Hippocrates, and they really work as philologists on Hippocrates, but then they get from Hippocrates a new method for medicine, and they connect also with the Paracelsian experience. So it becomes something very, very new and complicated, not only with different phases, but also when you think the problem is most of the philosophers went to the medical faculty. For example, this Francesco Patrizi that I said before, who becomes a philologist from one side and also a natural philosopher, a very innovative natural philosopher. He has gone to the, he has attended the school of medicine in Padova, and he begins not like not in the profession, in the medical profession, but as a philologist with medical ambitions also. Yeah. And the problem is also that in the Renaissance still there are two ways of being in the field of medicine. There's the surgeon, really the practical one, and then you have the philosophers. And the philosophers are interested only in the principles. And the other are interested in doing the little thing you can do in the 16th century to try not to not to die. and maybe during the 16th century, there is also, thanks to this kind of philologists and to the school of Paracelsus, there is then a crossing between the two perspectives, let's say. So then also with the aid of the alchemical perspective, which gives which moves in the direction of chemistry, you have a much more intellectual, philosophical based practice of medicine, let's say.
Yeah.